I speak like this. I'm white. I went to Oxford. It has been really easy for me to walk into very senior people's offices and ask for things and get them. And all that's done is then allow other people who would have had a harder time accessing, you know, funds or people to come and speak at events or whatever it is that we're asking for, to then really showcase themselves as being excellent at their work. I'd like to pretend that the military has really gotten to grips with things like sexual assault, and my clinical experience tells me that we haven't yet addressed that. These cases are monstrous. They ruin people's lives, and the thing that I see ruining people's lives is not even the sexual assault or the bullying. It's the way that the organisation then doesn't wrap its arms around that individual to make the problem go away.
Lieutenant Colonel Damien Jenkins is the consultant neurologist for Defence. He's youthful, energetic, cheerful, and super bright. He's also impatient for change, committed to rooting out the dark corners and encouraging leaders to share the light so others can grow and thrive. He was awarded the MBE for transforming the Army LGBT Plus network into a professional employee support group. Damien challenges perspectives and sees the impact of bad life experiences in the patients he treats. Join me for this encouraging tale of thoughtful leadership. I'm Lindsay Macduff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Damien.
I've got a few hats that I wear. I mean, my primary role is as a consultant neurologist for the Army. I'm the only one. In fact, I'm the only one across Defence. And that means I have a job at the hospital. So Defence is a bit unusual in that we employ doctors who actually work within the NHS, but are entirely owned and paid by the military. So that's me. So I offer neurology clinics to military folk, but also to NHS patients as well. But then I also oversee policy and direction for the MOD on all things to do with neurology. So brain injury, blast injury, cold injury, the whole gamut, really. When I'm not doing that, I'm also the SO1 for secondary healthcare, which is a specific job to Army rather than Defence. And in that job, I kind of oversee all of the Army consultants who are providing care. And really, we're all embedded in the NHS for a reason, and that is to keep our skill sets going so that we can deploy and go out the door and provide hospital care facilities abroad.
So you talked about a couple of your hats, but I think you have other hats too.
I do. Always been very lucky with my senior bosses. They've always allowed me to keep other hats on, which actually are not to do with the military. So I'm also a tutor in medicine in Oxford University at one of the colleges, St. Hugh's College. And more recently, I took on the job there as being dean, which is kind of an archaic job. They've been around for a very long time, and really they are a head of discipline for a college. Although as the world matures and gets into a nicer place, the job is morphing and it's increasingly not about discipline. It's more about welfare, well-being, and really cohering a sense of community within a college. And a college like St. Hugh's has 1,050 students. It has about 200 members of staff and about 75 academics. So it's a large old institution, and finding the kind of the means for holding us all together, pulling in the same direction, is just a wonderful job.
So that brings us up to date. Are there any other hats that you haven't declared?
Probably. We'll think about them.
Well, as you think about them, if we just wind back now to talk a bit about how you got to where you are today. So you're a lieutenant colonel in the Army. And when did your interest in joining the Army start?
So, I mean, I have to be really honest. I considered joining the Army in early 2001. I was already at Oxford studying medicine, and I was thinking, how am I going to continue paying for this degree? I don't have family money to have gotten through this, and the military offered a really generous cadetship. It wasn't the first time I'd thought about the military. I had done cadets as a kid, and also my mother's father and his older brother had both served. My mum's father actually was killed in Northern Ireland. He was an explosive ordnance warrant officer, and they were ambushed and killed. So when I joined, actually, there was a period of maternal purdah where my mother wouldn't speak to me for several months because she was absolutely gobsmacked I could join the military and put myself in the same, you know, harm's way that her father had. Although categorical differences between being a consultant neurologist and being a bombs disposal expert, that nuance was lost at the time.
So how did that happen? What was the route that you took to get into the army?
In Oxford, we still do a three-year pre-clinical and a three-year post-clinical kind of job. So you do all the science bits first, and then you do your in-hospital training. As you transition from one to the other is the time you can apply to join the military, and I did. I had a selection panel, as everyone does, although things were a bit easier then. I mean, we were facing war on two fronts, and we needed doctors at speed. So I think I got a free pass because the candidates coming through today are so much higher caliber than I was at the time. I would have, if I'd wanted the job now and using today's kind of entry standards, I'd have had to work a lot harder to be more militaristic. And I think I got a free pass and ended up just bimbling into the army. Almost by accident. Best accidental decision I ever made, really.
And going back to when you were growing up, you said you're in the cadets and you had your grandfather who'd been killed in Northern Ireland. Did that influence you towards the army, or was it just a pure motivation about how you're going to fund the completion of your degree?
The other services offered cadetships as well, but army was definitely the service for me. I mean, I don't mind being outside and being wet. I still do that for fun at weekends. That kind of sowed that seed for me. It was both the family history probably pushed me to the cadets. I enjoyed the cadets, which then pushed me towards army. So when it came to looking for additional funds, it was kind of an obvious win. And the people I met during the application process just reassured me of that. They were all senior, either retired clinicians or people who'd worked in recruiting doctors for a very long time. And they were just fantastic. They really reassured me that this would be a career I could get my teeth sunk into.
You're at Oxford. I was the first person in my family to go to university. I don't know whether that was in your background too. And where was home? Where were you living?
Yeah, no, I was also the first to go to university in my family. In fact, the second person to go to university was my mother about 10 years later.
Oh, really?
So I can't really tell you how I got to where I got, because I'm the eldest of six kids, and until the youngest, who's now in her early 20s, went off to university, there had been a period where people had gone off and done working jobs. My younger brother actually is a soldier in the RLC, he's a corporal, and actually he's now posted to the barracks I first worked at as a junior doctor coming out of Sandhurst, showing what a small world it is. But I grew up in South Wales in Chepstow, not in any way from a moneyed family, but I did have a lot of family input. So my grandmother helped bring me up along with my mum. My mum was young, a fantastic mum, and I got all the energy from having a young mum. But having this kind of grand maternal influence around meant that I got to school able to read some words already. Honestly think that kickstart is what got me a little bit ahead of the game all the way throughout. But then at my local primary school, the teacher there said, actually, our local schools are not great, and had suggested to my parents putting me into the local private school, which was well beyond their means. But it's the old days of the assisted places scheme, and I ended up as the poor kid in amongst a lot of very wealthy kids, but getting a really good education, and that probably did help. That system's now gone, because actually the local schools are really excellent, but it might have just been the route out for me.
And that opportunity that you had, I mean, how did it feel for a start when you felt like the outsider at this school?
So early on, it was fine. I think kids are super adaptable. It's only later when you start to appreciate difference and your own personality. I will be honest, I didn't end that school time happy, and I felt that I was other. By then, I'd also kind of clicked that I was gay as well, and that otherness was also causing trouble. I had a couple of years of being bullied, and the sense of not fitting in became really pressing for me, to the point that university was just this amazing release valve, and I got here and just made the most of it, because for once I didn't have to account for who I was, and that was just really liberating.
And that contrast was really marked. And when you arrived at university, did you feel like you belonged, that this was your place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've never really left Oxford, although I've been a doctor and worked all across the world, and you know, the army's taken me in different directions. I've always kept a home here in Oxford. I've always felt it kind of spiritually centering, and this probably explains why I still do this work for college. It feels like a family to me. It feels like a home to me, and I owe it quite a lot, and it's nice paying back.
And in your dean role, you're now looking at and learning and understanding and supporting undergraduates primarily, I presume, and postgrads too?
Yeah, it's a mix, actually. The college, for the first time in its history, has more postgraduates than undergraduates. It's about 450 to 500. Trying to help the young is really interesting. The risk of sounding like a young-aged fogey. I think that they are now sufficiently distant time-wise from my time at university that they feel like a different generation. They are much more aware of global affairs. They have a finger on the pulse of equality and diversity. And that's their skill set over what we had coming to university. We were a little bit more blinkered about what was happening around us. The trade-off has been we were much more grounded in our local communities. I see people desperate to want to make the world a better place, but feeling helpless. And one of the things that is missing, perhaps, in their armory just yet is this knowledge that if you can't make the world a better place in one go, you can make your local community really strong and a wonderful place. And from that grows the more global community that is better off.
That's a challenging environment for them to be in. How do you, with your team, manage that?
It's mostly providing guide rails for them to figure out the world for themselves. You can't really tell undergraduates or graduates your own viewpoint without sounding patronizing. That's one of the things I learned very rapidly. What you can do is you can talk to your own experiences about your own time and similar experiences as a kind of comparator for them. But you can also make sure that they understand that the things they're doing are reasonable. Listening in for them and saying, you're managing it. This is free speech and you're testing really tricky ideas. And the sense you have of it being awkward or tricky is completely right. And you only have to worry when that feeling goes away. Just providing that kind of safety net for them is really all we can do. They're really intelligent individuals. They'll find their own way through this.
That learning and knowledge that they have is equally relevant in the military, where even though it's a hierarchical organization, the knowledge and understanding isn't solely in the domain of the senior members, the more experienced members of the organization. How does that contrast in your experience with your university experience?
They are very similar. There's no getting away from it. You know, they're similar age people with tons of enthusiasm who go out and gain a lot of experience ahead of their peers. The natural corollary of what we do in Oxford is that people go off and lead the world, and it's no different in the military. We start off with people who go to Purbright, go to Sandhurst, and then find their feet and then use their skill sets to go up and up the chain to lead people. They're both people organizations, effectively. All that we really do, as I said earlier, is provide guide rails for people to find themselves. And the more authentic they find their own voice as being, the better they typically do and the better able they are to lead other people. It's very not hierarchical in Oxford. And increasingly, although we have ranks, I think the army has completely changed in my time. You know, this is 22 years in. We wear our rank on our shoulders and we don't have to really mention it ever again because we just listen to the best person in the room for the most part.
And winding back to your decision to join, you joined in 2002, I think it was, right, which is 2 years after the ban excluding gay people from joining was lifted. Was that a factor in your decision to join?
It really gave me a pause for thought. I really wasn't sure whether or not I was going to fit in. I actually really worried that it was going to be me putting myself into an organization that reflected school, where I was going to be an outsider again and where I wasn't going to really find my feet. And that couldn't have been further from the truth. The army is a very broad church. And usually, if you're willing to tip up and do your job, you've crossed the threshold. If you can play along and join in and show willing and you're nice to other folk, it's usually okay. I accept not everyone has that experience. It's not always like that. You know from your experience, and I know from mine, that there is a job of work to still be done to root out the dark corners in the army and make sure they go away. But I've seen such a transition in my time that people are much more accepting. But having spoken to people who retired, they think that was always true.
Yes, there's a degree of aspic, I think, that community has, which has its risk. But you talked about the transition and the change, and we first met when you were the chair of the Army LGBT Plus Network in 2011. It was very clear when I arrived that you were transforming the network as well. And the network was designed, I and you can tell us a bit more about the network, but its purpose was to support the community. You made it a really effective, high-performing network and was awarded an MBE for your efforts. What would you say are the key ingredients to have a successful network?
Again, it's always the people. The truth to tell, we could have done all the work that we did within the network itself. It still required having people like you, like General Everard around, who are willing to help us and create a space for us. Luck does play some role in things, and timing matters. And one of the things I'd say to anyone who wants to drive a cause forward is, it may not be right now, but have another go at another time with another group of faces, because if your cause is just, it will land. When I took over the Army LGBT front, I effectively got asked to take it over. It was a gentleman's decision. It was like, you're a young officer who's gay, you do this thing. And I, it wasn't really at all on my radar. But when it came onto my radar, it effectively fell foul to my need to organize and structure things. And it hadn't had that before. It was a small group of people doing a lot of good social work for individuals who were struggling. That's about all they could do. It's a bit of firefighting and helping in that space that you were talking about, the kind of bullying and harassment space. That didn't seem like quite enough for me. I really felt that I knew quite a lot of gay people in the military and actually some openly trans people, which was a really brave kind of step for certain folk to take, particularly in our world. And I knew that they were there, and I knew that they were enjoying their jobs, and I knew that they were accepting their communities. So I knew that there was also a good news story out there. And I just wondered if in kind of finding more people, dragging more people in, and then using people's life experiences and it kind of shouting them out from the rooftops, if we could just let a lot of other people who might be having an okay time know that we're all here and you can crack on and be who you are and be more open about yourself. I think that's the goal we actually achieved. We ended up with hundreds of people in the Army LGBT forum, and by then you have the kind of critical mass. You can't look around without seeing that your regiment has got a few gay people and they're living their lives doing whatever. And that was really nice. You know, when we think about the protected characteristics, some things are obvious. You know, if you're black or a woman, it is obvious. Well, my friends would say it's obvious that I'm gay, but it's not always obvious. And, you know, we have bi people and we have people who are trans and who haven't transitioned. Allowing them to know that they're valid, that they've got a space, that the Army is still a good employer for them, still wants them, I think was really important. And I think the strength of the forum has really just been, you know, its ever-increasing size and the energy people throw into it. The other thing that's really, I think, important about networks is knowing when it's your time to go. I think the energy that you bring in is probably expendable. It's probably a cap to how much you can bring. And you can hang around and enjoy the glory moment, but actually that probably ossifies your organization, and you do need new blood. Karen Stiles took over from me, did an amazing job. We've had officers and soldiers, we've had reserves and we've had regulars. That has been the nicest thing. It wasn't achieving what I felt was the goal I wished to achieve to start with. It's the fact it's grown and continue growing with absolutely no sense of my hand being anywhere near the tiller.
And do you think that success was partly because you had a conscious decision about rotating people through to get the energy to then give people respite or a break so they can concentrate on their day job? Also, that you had a plan about who you were aiming to be your successors, or was that much more organic?
No, that was much more organic. Before we had this conversation, you were talking about leadership style. And I don't necessarily think I have a leadership style. I think I kind of morph into for whatever a group requires.
No, but I think that is a leadership style. I mean, what you're describing there is a plural leadership styles that you adapt to suit the circumstances and the environment and the people and the task, presumably, that you're dealing with. Is that fair?
I think that probably is fair. And I think that plays nicely into what I was going to say about the one leadership attribute I absolutely buy into is leaders should be there to remove obstacles from other people's path. I absolutely believe that. I mean, I speak like this. I'm white. I went to Oxford. It has been really easy for me to walk into very senior people's offices and ask for things and get them. And all that's done is then allow other people who would have had a harder time accessing, you know, funds or people to come and speak at events or whatever it is that we're asking for, to then really showcase themselves as being excellent at their work, and it gives the old fusties a chance to look and think, oh, I probably wouldn't have necessarily had that person pegged as a new or future leader. And all of a sudden, they've got the platform they need. One of the things that I see is the old person who is in a senior position, who's like a tall tree in a rainforest. They grow tall, and then they have to grow their canopy to grab all the light, and they do it at the exclusion of other trees, and little trees underneath die. It's really important not to be that person. There is space enough for all the trees to grow. You have to find that, not take too much of the light yourself if you want people to do well.
And that requires some self-awareness and emotional intelligence, and also honesty amongst others, the smaller trees, to explain that perhaps they're taking too much of the light.
Yeah, I think that's right. I spend quite a lot of my time calling people out, or at least making them face the truth of what it is they're saying. This is absolutely true in my clinical work, for example. People come in with unusual or unrealistic expectations, and I have really frank conversations with them, and that allows us to develop such a lovely rapport that we can find a way through whatever their medical problem is. Given how frightful I can be for my patients in clinic, my colleagues don't really understand why my patients still want to come back, and they keep coming back and they don't write in complaints. And I think it's because seeing their problems early and understanding how you're not going to be able to help them unless you address the elephant in the room early, which causes a bit of a jarring moment for them. And then we spend the rest of our clinic time building up the rapport. What my colleagues have been doing is getting increasingly angry over a 30-minute appointment and then blurting out all the stuff that they should have said in the first 5 minutes, in the last 5 minutes. And this one amazing psychological trait everyone needs to take away: people remember the last thing, not the first thing that you say to them. So if you want to say something that challenges somebody, do it early, allow them to sink in, and then spend the rest of the time being nice, because they'll take away the niceness. It's a really important skill set for not being complained about. And that's true in medicine, military, and in academia.
When you joined the army, and actually before that, did you have role models and leaders that you looked to and thought, yes, that's someone who I would like to aspire to, the good kind of tree?
This is going to sound really parochial, because I didn't really have those leaders in kind of walks of life, you know, senior walks of life. I had members of my family, proper close-knit Welsh family, a matriarchal society, and seeing people be kind of deft at being kind of brutally honest whilst being loving was a style of leadership I really just got used to and could wield myself. So really, it was the senior women in my family who were the early leaders who shaped everything for me. Unfortunately, this is going to sound very sycophantic, but you're also an exceptional leader, culture colonel. You created space for people who needed some space, and you took a lot of top flak for people whilst they got going in their networks. And then those networks found their feet and have grown ever since. There is a bravery in that. And we forget, actually, that the moral courage sometimes means taking a lot of hits for a cause that you know will grow and do well. And you did that, and I hopefully exemplified that after you.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I didn't see it quite like that. I didn't think that's what I was doing, because what I was trying to do was to find senior leaders that had much more power and ability to shape and influence the environment. And I remember we were looking for a patron, and I thought that I would ask General Everard. You've mentioned him already, and he was really up for it. And I said, it's not a big ask, they won't ask you very much. And I wrote a draft forward for him, and I emailed it to him. And within a couple of seconds, I had a call back saying, did you write this? And it's really not what I want to say. And so, I mean, he was lovely. It wasn't a horrible thing how he said it. It was just, as you said, honest and really helpful. And he said, don't worry, I'll do this. And this was a two-star general who was doing one of the busiest jobs in the army headquarters. And he wrote back with this, I thought, amazingly authentic manifesto about what he wanted. And I think he made a massive difference.
He really did. I mean, the lovely thing about working with General Everard was, again, the ability to say what he would and wouldn't do, to be honest, but also just to think kindly about people. His natural working assumption was people are good and people will do good if you can allow them to, you know, leverage their best self. It was super working with him. I was actually at Sovereign's Parade once at Sandhurst as the guest of one of the then chaplains. And there was this almighty ruckus on the fold-down stadium seating as he clambered down three flights of chairs to give me a cuddle. Which got a lot of looks because he had a lot of bling and I didn't.
Oh, brilliant. It makes a big difference, I think, people who unexpectedly have an impact in your life and it carries forward. Do you have others that you see having that effect on the next generation coming through?
So many different options. Can I twist it and say something else? I think that one of the things that's been worrying me over the last few years, and I see this across all my different jobs. If I give you an example from my clinical job, the doctors coming up training behind me as neurologists, I think, are having a harder time of it than we had. The amount of time that seniors are able to give them to help them learn new skills, to test their hypothesis, and also to kind of ferment their personality traits in a way that is going to set them up as, you know, future consultants and leaders, has kind of gone away. And I think we are in a real risk moment in things like the NHS and the military, where our numbers have dwindled and everyone's wearing two hats and carrying two workloads, that we're not investing enough time now in the people below us. And we got to where we got because people invested their time and energies into us. That was a significant proportion of time. I really worry we're not investing as much now in younger people because we don't have the time and we have to find that time again. That's not answering your question. That's answering it with a negative, effectively.
No, but what it does is helps people think about what their responsibility is. You talked about how leaders' role is to remove barriers from other people. Actually, that's exactly what you've just described. The military does invest in professional development a lot, but you need not just the professional development, I think, but also the personal development.
Agreed. I absolutely agree. Learning from the person who did the job before you, but also opening your mind to the ways that you might do the job differently, are so important for the kind of natural and organic development of any organisation. And actually, you know, the military is a young person's game. You know, most people are out on their ear at your tender age. You have to really feed forward, you know, that some of them are 18 and are going to go on to amazing things. And we just have to plow our energies into them. I see it more in the army than I do in the NHS or the university, actually. I think we have still got that. But I worry that we'll fall into the same public service trap of people being too busy. And I think possibly, you know, I see that with the senior clinicians I work with within the military. We're busy because we have to wear this NHS hat. We have to do our deployments. We've got our training. We're doing policy work. But we still have to make room. We have to make room for those youngsters who are going to replace us. Because we all want out at some point. You've got to have somebody coming up behind to take the job.
And I remember that when you were chairing the network, you found time to offer the opportunity for people to have training. And I particularly remember you did amazing unconscious bias training. Recently, that's had some bad press that compulsory unconscious bias training can have the opposite effect that you seek. And yours was voluntary. But the angle that you approached it from, I think, was from your day job, your neurology day job. Can you talk a little bit about why you thought that worked?
I think you're right. I think the fact I was at that point a trainee neurologist really interested in cognition, how we make our thoughts, meant that unconscious bias, which at that point was still in its really embryonic stage, it became an industry. And I think the backlash has been effectively the bad industrialization and delivery of what is essentially just a natural part of being human and something we should all be aware of has probably unfortunately cost the rep of unconscious bias quite a lot. I'm very interested in decision making, and it's quite clear that lots of people make poor decisions, particularly about other people, and they don't mean to. And that's because complex decisions really need time and space and an effort, and we don't really create the time to do that. So when I started doing the training, I really came at it from that neurology perspective, and I talked really about decision making first and foremost, and then bolted on bias and how we can make bad decisions onto that. But really it was allowing people just to go away and think about their own thought making so they could question it.
Our listener is thinking, how do you fit all these things in? And my question is, Do you relax? And if so, how do you relax?
By being with friends is the easy answer. I spend a lot of time with my friends just chilling out, going for walks. Holidays are almost uniformly walking holidays. It's being outside for me. And actually, I often will run in or out of work. That creates just a small moment on either side of a work day that allows me to declog my mind. I think it's becoming harder. I think anyone listening to this who's in the military will think, oh, actually, it's becoming harder and harder to cleave out some personal space. It's really important to make that happen in some way, shape or form. And it's really important to have personal space. We've all got friends or family that require us to be around, but we also have ourselves, and we do need to keep yourself rooted means having to spend some time with yourself. If you don't do that, you can sleepwalk into being a different version of you, and it may not be the one that you want to arrive at in your future. So having time to just think through your own thoughts, be alone, really very important.
I know you read a lot, and in your reading, do you use the eloquence of others to help describe what you want to say, but using their words? So do you use other people's quotations to help articulate your thinking? And if so, do you have a go-to quotation that you find is almost apposite in any situation?
So you'll love this. The answer is no, because I have a really bad memory. So one of the problems with being busy and on the go all the time is that doesn't provide enough time to lay down really good memories. So I read a lot, but I can reread books because I can't really remember the words. So I'm actually a big Virginia Woolf fan. I love the way that the words just wash over you, and the eloquence and the kind of breadth of the vocab I always find really stunning, but I can't remember it. That's really upsetting for me, because one of the things that my peers in both the Army and Oxford do is reach for quotes, sometimes reach for whole poems, and I can't do that. And I think unfortunately, it's a really good party trick for looking really bright, and it's not one I own.
And now what's next for you, Damien?
I really don't know. I mean, Advanced Staff College beckons, possibly. It's tricky if you're a hospital doctor to go and do a course that's a year out of clinical practice, because you really have to ask, am I willing to give up doing the job that I have spent 24 years training for? And the answer has so far been no. But again, I think the one thing that we all have in common in the military, at least, is you don't really want to get stuck, because getting stuck is boring and then you go off the boil. So if the only way for me to continue having novelty and new challenge is Staff College, then that's probably the next step. Unless there's some really remarkable new clinical role I can take on. But the one thing that's true about our job is you really have no idea what is around the corner. And any plan I make for next year will be thrown out the window, you know, if we have to go and put our boots on the ground somewhere else, or if a new emerging threat is found. So I can't really tell you what next year is going to look like.
Dealing with uncertainty, is that something that you do well or not?
It's an interesting one. I've been reflecting on this a lot, because I think I'd say I do deal with uncertainty well, but in most of my jobs, I deal with other people's uncertainty. That isn't really uncertainty in my daily life. And actually, I think I'm possibly bad at dealing with uncertainty in my personal world. I think I actually need that solid bedrock, which is unusual, because I always like to think that I'm a flexible, adaptable individual, but that's always in the workspace. And this is what I was coming back to. You do need to carve out time to be on your own and just to think, who am I at home on my own when nobody else is around and when I'm not at work doing things for other people? Because quite a lot of my jobs are, you know, all of my efforts are going into other people's lives, figuring out their problems. And it would be really easy to sleepwalk away from my life into theirs and leave nothing of me left for retirement, which is a little way off yet.
Is there anything that you think I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
That's a really good question. I touched on the fact that I was bullied at school, and I think that left a really helpful little vein in me that carries through now. I really hate seeing people being deprived or being bullied or being harassed. And I think that really does come through in every bit of my job. I try and liberate resources for people. And those resources vary. You know, it could be, you know, a wheelchair for somebody. It could be a blue badge for somebody. It can be getting a job. It can be an opportunity to go abroad on a study trip. But I really want people not to be deprived just based on the way they look, who they are, where they come from, and understanding that we deal with people in a very superficial way. We don't really know what's necessarily going on and under the skin. We don't know the journey people have been on to get them where they are. And we make a lot of assumptions, and that can be really harmful for folk. So being as laid back, relaxed, and open to people's separate experience is so important for me in all the different hats I wear. But that all comes from that. Pretty sure if I hadn't been bullied at school, that would not necessarily have been a natural character trait for me.
In your clinical work, you deal not only with people through the NHS, but also military, army personnel, military personnel. Do you see that the challenges that the younger generation face in terms of when they are being bullied are being addressed effectively?
So I think that we, particularly the army, because we're larger and because we have a regimental structure, I think we have some of the very best in inclusive employment practices and places to go and work. But I think we probably also have some of the darker ones. In my clinical world, I deal with people who present as though they have a neurological problem. It can be through something that looks like a seizure, for example, but actually it's coming from a psychological place. So it's a dissociative seizure. And when you see that, it's almost uniformly because somebody's had a really bad life experience. And I'd like to pretend that the military has really gotten to grips with things like sexual assault. And my clinical experience tells me that we haven't yet addressed that. I think it's difficult for us, actually, because I think, you know, we are of old a brothers in arms organization. And it's very difficult to look at somebody you know, trust, and have worked with for a long time and have a good working relationship with and think anything wrong of them. But these cases are monstrous. They ruin people's lives. And the thing that I see ruining people's lives is not even the sexual assault or the bullying. It's the way that the organization then doesn't wrap its arms around that individual to make the problem go away. Our employment standards and our rules about this are really good, actually. On paper, we're excellent. And that means in certain, you know, go back to my original point, in certain areas, this is dealt with excellently, but it's not dealt with uniformly. And that is a goal that we should be striving to achieve.
Damien discusses the deeply damaging impact of bullying, harassment, and discrimination. It isn't surprising because it's derived from his personal and professional experience. As a gay man who joined the army soon after the lifting of the ban, he acknowledges much progress has been made, but sets out with clarity that there is still much more to be done before everyone can flourish. His encouragement for leaders to be trees, to share the light and create space for others to grow, was powerful. And I love that he sees the role of leaders as obstacle busters, giving others access to opportunities so they can shine. Please let me know what shone out for you and why. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.